From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back 40 years. 40 years ago today, 1975, we were in the midst of what has become known as Operation Baby Lift, the name given to the mass evacuation of children from South Vietnam to the United States and other countries, including Australia, France, and Canada. And by the end of the Vietnam War and the fall of Saigon, we're talking about more than 3,300 infants involved with Operation Baby Lift. And so this hour, we're trying to understand the legacy and the impact of Operation Baby Lift in a number of ways. And my colleague Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail is here. A bit of a diversion, a departure from a typical start to Innovation Friday.
But a really important story, Evan.
Absolutely.
And one that we wanted to take advantage of because of a significant anniversary, which is actually tomorrow, the 25th, which is not only Anzac Day for those of you who are following that particular little historical centenary, but Operation Baby Lift, the last flight that was considered part of Operation Baby Lift was tomorrow. And as part of that observance, a lot of adoptees and families and people who are involved in that incredible sort of humanitarian effort are gathering at the New Jersey Vietnam Veterans Memorial tomorrow and the Vietnam Era Museum to reunite, to get back together and to talk about this remarkable kind of set of events and to help us kind of chart a path through this really complicated moment in 20th century history. I'm happy to be joined by Lana May Noon. Lana's on the phone from New Jersey, and Lana has a really deep and very personal connection, as you'll hear, with Operation Baby Lift. Lana, thanks very much for being with us on Connections today.
Thank you so much for having me. Honored to be with you today. Thank you.
So we're going to hear today in this hour, Evan, we've spoken to three former adoptees. These were babies who were evacuated from Saigon in as you said, 40 years ago, who are now Americans and have lived their lives here, have different relationships to Vietnam, to what their understanding of the events of this period really mean, and we'll be hearing from them and also other people who've remained involved, including a veteran in the second half of this hour, a Vietnam veteran who was on the ground on rotation in Vietnam and had a really close association with the orphanages where a lot of these children were brought together before evacuation. And he's also maintained a really strong connection and still works with development projects there, and we'll hear from him later. But Lana, can you take us back to 40 years ago and what were the kind of events on the ground that led to what we now know is Operation Baby Lift?
Well, thank you very much. Great question. 40 years ago today, my husband Byron and I were awaiting the arrival of our daughter from Vietnam. We had completed a home study, as all adoptive parents do, and we were approved in February 1975. Then in March, we were told the babies that were already processed to go to their adoptive families would never get out of Vietnam because each day the country of South Vietnam got smaller and smaller as the Viet Cong marched south. And then at the end of March, there was the Maverick flight. World Airways, Ed Daly, brought out 57 Vietnamese war orphans. They landed April 2nd in San Francisco. The next day, President Gerald R. Ford, who is himself an adoptee, authorized Operation Baby Lift with the help of Robert Kane at the Presidio and many, many others.
And later this hour, too, we're going to hear from Sister Mary Nell Gage, who was a sister who was on the ground working with orphans in Vietnam and also was in the Presidio when Operation Baby Lift was underway. But Lana, before then too, a lot of the evacuation before Gerald Ford's proclamation, there was actually a huge amount of humanitarian effort being done essentially by nonprofits, Catholic welfare agencies and so on, wasn't there?
Yes, absolutely. Seven agencies, including Pearl, SBUX, Welcome House, Friends of Children of Vietnam, Sherry Clark, Ross Nieder, the group you mentioned, Sister Mary Nell Gage, with Rosemary Taylor and Sister Susan McDonald, Friends for All Children, and Hope International over in Oregon, a huge agency involved. So seven agencies were authorized to bring children to the United States for purposes of adoption.
So, of course, the conditions, and Sister Marinelle will tell this, add to this a bit later, but obviously very, very grave and desperate conditions for a lot of people who were being displaced by the advancing North Vietnamese army. Listeners, many of whom may have been with our screening of The Last Days of Vietnam at the Little Theatre earlier this week, which is also screening on WXXI TV next week on the 28th, 9 p.m. on WXXI, Last Days in Vietnam, will also get a sense of just how incredibly chaotic and desperate times were for people, both obviously foreign nationals who were there, but also for nationals in Vietnam. And can you give us a little bit of a sense of why was there this sense of urgency, perhaps, Lana, to kind of get these children out?
Yes. Well, of course, as you mentioned, the situation was chaotic. The children were in harm's way. And my feeling is that no matter who you liked or didn't like and what was happening in Vietnam, whatever side of the picture you were on, those children were not at the top of anybody's list, because of the difficulty and chaos and just the very, very dire straits they were in. And so I believe the only thing that could have been done to help those children was to evacuate them at the time. And many unsung heroes, as you say, in that very difficult time were concerned about those children.
Now tell us, just take us through what happened when, so you set us up with you and your husband, Byron, waiting for this little child to come from Vietnam. Can you tell us what happened then?
Yes, thank you. President Ford authorized baby lift on April 2nd. On April 2nd, the baby started coming in, Presidio. Robert Kane was an unsung hero in all of this, as I mentioned. And we had a photo, a black and white, blurry photo of our daughter. We named her Heather, and we started waiting. Everyone got called to the airport but us. Your baby's on the way, but she's been hospitalized. She's quite ill. Our daughter Heather was hospitalized at Clark Air Force Base, Philippines, then Long Beach Naval Hospital, then Denver Children's Hospital. Finally, we got the call on April 23rd. Come to JFK, she's on her way home. We went to JFK and we met our daughter, Heather. She was very, very ill. She was hospitalized on the final day of the Vietnam War. I watched the fall of Saigon from her hotel TV set, and she died on May 17th, 1975, of pneumocystis carini pneumonia, which is a very debilitating disease often seen in AIDS patients.
Yes.
And can I just jump in and just remind our listeners, how old was Heather when she arrived in late April? How old was she?
She was very tiny, under 6 pounds. They did a wrist bone age, and it was pre-newborn. And, of course, we said, what does that mean? And we were told she was so premature and so badly malnourished that her bone age didn't register as a newborn. It registered pre-newborn. And for 40 years, I've always felt everyone involved in getting her home to us was an unsung hero, and we're very grateful to everyone.
Now, I understand tomorrow, too, Lana, that there's an unveiling of a plaque to commemorate Heather at the event in New Jersey. Is that right?
Yes, and that was designed by a wonderful Vietnam veteran named Charlie Wilbur, and his daughter has helped tremendously in planning tomorrow's event along with everyone. At the center, Kathleen Wilbur is our event planner, master of ceremonies, and everyone at the New Jersey Vietnam Era Educational Center, they've just been wonderful for this huge event. We're also premiering readings from the first babylist play called Children of the April Rain, written by 9 participants in babylist, performed by an off-Broadway Actors Equity and Non-Equity Theater Company, Infinite Variety Productions. Ashley Adelman is their CEO. Amanda Cohen is their director.
And just in terms of back to your personal story, Lana, that following that you did actually adopt again, and your daughter Jenny arrived, and she, we're sad, glad to say, is now married, and is 40. So, could you just tell us a little bit about? Obviously, you've been through this incredibly distressing event with Heather, and then Jenny arrives, and you're able to start to parent her. What were the sort of challenges and things that you and your husband kind of dealt with in those early days?
Well, thank you. And she was actually on that final flight that left Vietnam April 25th with some other unsung heroes, Sister Therese LeBlanc, a Roman Catholic nun, Sherry Clark, and Ross Nieder. And they actually went back to Vietnam after being evacuated once to get some of the babies out. They were also helped by Sally Vineyard, Defense Attaché Office, and General Homer Duggan Smith, the last commanding general of the Vietnam War. Jenny, too, was hospitalized several times en route. She's the final baby ever placed from the Vietnam baby list because she remained in hospital until June 5th, and then she arrived home to us. We also adopted a son from Korea, my son Jason Moon, and I also have two grandchildren, Heather and Jaden. So it's been a wonderful 40 years.
Thanks, Lana. So just stay with us. We're going to cross now to one of the interviews that we did this week with a man called Greg Hodges. Greg actually grew up in Cahokta, New York, in Steuben County, and we caught up with him on the phone yesterday and got him to sort of reflect on what he understood about his story, obviously a lot of gaps in his memories and understanding, and also just to sort of reflect on his relationship to Vietnam and his thoughts on being an adoptee. Here he is.
My story, as I get older, the details seem to change and sometimes get murkier. I was originally told that I was on the plane crash, the C-5A Galaxy plane crash that happened on April 5th of 1975. Later on, I've learned that I was not on that airplane, but I was on the airplane that flew out the day after that crash. My parents had the adoption process through the Go Vap orphanage in Saigon in process approximately 6 months prior to my evacuation. So when I got evacuated, my adoptive parents had no idea I was coming to America. And they had gotten the phone call out of LaGuardia saying, you know, you guys live in New York. You know, can you come pick up your son? And the person on the phone had assumed that anybody from New York lived in New York City. Well, my parents lived in Steuben County, Western New York, outside of Rochester. And they said, well, it takes us about 8 hours to get down there. And so they ended up putting me in a hospital with one of the flight attendees. And the hospital wouldn't release me because I was 14 pounds at just 18 months. But because my mom was a nurse, an LPN, they did release me to her. So I was able to come home, you know, after I arrived in LaGuardia.
Yes, people forget how big New York State is, really, right?
That's right.
So, you've kind of pieced together more details, I guess. Obviously, there was a lot of chaos, but clearly your adoptive parents here in the States had already reached out and had taken the initiative to want to adopt a child from Vietnam before Operation Baby Lift came into effect, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
On my 30th birthday, they gave me a bunch of letters from the nuns from the orphanage corresponding back and forth about my well-being, that they needed some extra money, what the process was going to be. And they really had no clue how they were going to get me out. And somehow I made it on one of the airplanes during the evacuation.
Yeah. What do you remember about your life in upstate New York, sort of growing up? What sort of conversations did your parents have? Did they sort of sit down and have a kind of formal adoption conversation with you at some point in your childhood?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, me being Asian and my adoptive parents are Caucasian, you always knew there was a difference. And so it's not like they sat me down and said, oh, one day, by the way, you're adopted. It's kind of like, you know, you always kind of know you're a male or a female for the most part, and no one ever sits you down and says, oh, by the way, you're a male or you're a girl. You just kind of know that growing up. And I always just knew I was adopted growing up. I grew up in Cahokta, New York, and I graduated, you know, in a class of 18 kids, where 10 of us started kindergarten together. The town's only 600 people. And that community is not very diverse racially. So, you know, I don't want to say I stuck out, but, you know, I was one of three Asian kids in town. and the whole community just accepted us as, you know, being part of the community.
Yeah. And so, have
yeah,
you...
Yeah, my childhood was wonderful. I have no complaints about that childhood.
Right. And so have you sort of been back to Vietnam, or has there been any... Have you ever tried to reach out and find out anything about your birth parents? Is that information that the orphanage had, or could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I probably have enough information to find out who my birth parents are. Honestly, I don't have any desire to do so. You know, just I have wonderful adoptive parents, and like I said, I just don't have that desire to find out who my birth parents are. I do have a desire to go back to Vietnam just to see, you know, where I grew up and where I came from. And this earlier this month, a bunch of the adoptees that were evacuated went back to Vietnam. I was planning on going, and then my adoptive parents decided they were going to plan a summer trip this summer to some of the national parks. So I actually chose to do the family trip with my family here in the United States versus go to Vietnam. And I guess, if anything, that kind of speaks about, you know, how I value my American life, you know. It just, you know, I got a family here, and, you know, I'd rather spend it with them than go to Vietnam this summer.
Sure. No, I understand. So there are some people, I guess, it's important to realize that everyone's, there's a big variety of experience of people who came to America through Operation Baby Lift and had different kind of perspectives on their experience and their heritage, and clearly you know you're an American, you know, you're American, and you identify really strongly and have your roots here. So what kind of place does the story of Operation Baby Lift have, you know, when we're seeing all these sort of commemorative events? Is it something that you feel kind of engaged with, or what sort of emotions does it kind of stir up for you?
This month stirs up some emotions because it is the 40th anniversary of, you know, when I came to America, which is a significant event. The actual and the baby lift does stir up some emotion, but, you know, it's part of the history, and it's a part of I was like I said, I was 18 months, so I don't fully remember those events. So to me, they were just something. Hey, this is what happened. I was told or read this is what happened. I don't really remember it, so I don't have any sentimental feelings about those events. But, you know, I recognize that they're significant events in my life.
Sure. It's kind of like your first birthday that you don't remember, right?
Exactly.
So, Greg, just tell us a little bit about your life now. So you're working in a civil service post?
Well, I guess all my life I sort of lived the American dream. You know, I served in the military. I ended up using the GI Bill to get my education. And now I work as an engineer for the federal government, and I work with Navy ships. So, I mean, so, you know, the opportunity that America has given me, you know, I've taken advantage of. And so, you know, I live a very happy life. And, you know, I work hard. I went to school, and I have a good, very close relationship with my adoptive family. And
that's great, Greg. Yep. Hey, thanks so much for sharing your story with us, and enjoy the summer in the national parks of the U.S.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
That's Greg Hodges telling his story to Matthew Leonard. And you know, as we're finding out this hour, everyone's got a bit of a different take. I mean, no two people are exactly the same. Greg is talking about his happy life with his adoptive family here, his connection to his American family, his sort of lack of interest in birth parents. We're going to hear some different takes on birth parents later this hour. And Lana Noon's on the line with us, who is an adoptive parent who, as she described, lost her first adoptive daughter, Heather, just a few weeks after Heather arrived from Operation Baby Lift, but then adopted Jenny. And Jenny is doing very well, and Lana is a grandmother, and Lana, you hear Greg's story, you hear other stories, and I'm curious. I don't want to probe too much, but I'm curious to know how often Jenny and you have talked about birth parents and sort of the sensitivities there.
Yes, well, thank you. Jennifer actually lived in Vietnam for a while, and she went and visited her orphanage. It's still there, and different memorial spots. We did a memorial service for Heather, and she went back to that spot several times. I don't believe she has done a search for her birth parents. Of course, that might change. Everything is always flexible. We have had the opportunity to talk about things for the past 40 years, and my family also wrote a book together called Global Mom, Notes from an Adoptive Family. I believe it's the first and perhaps only book written by an entire family. My husband, myself, Jenny, and Jason are all in the book. And we have done some different interviews over the years and reunions, and that's been wonderful and very helpful. And hopefully it's helped us bond together with Jennifer and my son as well, and all the grandkids too.
So let's hear, Lana, we're going to hear from someone I know you know very well, Sister Mary Noel Gage. And she's also going to kind of tease out some of these ideas. She talks a little bit about the reunion, some of the motherland tours, the so-called motherland tours, where adoptees were able to go back to Vietnam and kind of reconnect with their culture. And some of them also started to sort of think about their birth, their families of origin, and the kind of questions that raised. But she was someone really in the middle of this whole venture, wasn't she, Lana? Because she was on the ground in Vietnam before, and as she tells us in her interview, she was sort of there before and after, and sort of saw things from both sides of the Pacific, really.
Yes, she is definitely one of our unsung heroes in all of this, and just her story is just so evocative of everything that happened during that time, and she'll be with us tomorrow, and she's speaking at the New Jersey event, so it'll be great to see her again.
So let's hear from her. She'll tell us how she sort of got into the whole thing, and then her continued association with the Operation Baby Lift adoptees.
I had been a high school teacher, and this was in the early summer, and so I resigned my teaching position and went to Vietnam, and then spent from that point until 1975 there living in the nursery where we were caring for. Well, when I first got there, we had about 65 children, and then as time marched on, we increased the numbers of children who were in our care to about 100. And then because of some kind of crazy communication, I came to the East Coast to do some fundraising talks at various churches for some of the groups who were supporting us there in Vietnam. And while I was on that, if you will, public relations tour, I got a call from one of our supporters in San Francisco that an evacuation plan was underway and to come immediately to San Francisco, which I did. And so I was at the Presidio, a good week, maybe 10 days. And then I was up at McChord Air Force Base at the end of April for receiving children as they were coming into McChord and then being cared for at Fort Lewis.
And can I just take you back a little bit to before you returned to the United States? Could you give us a sense of what sort of humanitarian crisis was underway in Vietnam in those sort of final couple of years of the conflict, and what you were seeing on the ground with the children that you were caring for?
Devastating poverty, war, ceaseless war, which then led to the abandonment, the relinquishment of children for whom birth parents simply could not care. And so our operation kept increasing the numbers of children who needed our care all the time. And at the same time, we were very much aware of the continuation of the war. Even though American troops had withdrawn in early 1973. The war did not end. And people having fled from the countryside, setting up what they could on sidewalks, bits of canvas, some kind of tarp, and, you know, just living wherever they could. It's a kind of poverty that and social upheaval that we in this country we haven't experienced for 150 years since the Civil War, and most persons alive in the Western world don't have personal experience of that.
And so fast forward, if you would, now to the mid-1980s, and I understand you're still very much involved in the organization of reunions and of trips back to Vietnam for those original adoptees who were, some of them, babes in arms or toddlers, obviously, when they were evacuated. Could you talk us a little bit about how that came about?
Yes. I think the very first summer there in 1975, aware that these adoptive parents with these new children wanted some connection to other families who were going through the same steps, then we had really casual, not highly organized picnics and gatherings for people to share. And then in 1985, we had a large gathering of more than 700 adoptees. But, of course, at that point, you know, they're 10, 11, 12 years old. So their adoptive parents and siblings are coming for the reunion. And the most important piece is that they have met and have fallen in love with each other. They are, as we used to say, from crib mates now to soulmates. Children who share diapers and bottles and cribs and bassinets and little wind-up swings now are, you know, swimming together in the pool or playing basketball or just sitting in a group and sharing some of their deeply felt emotions about growing up Asian in a town in which they may be the only person who's not really white.
I just had another question, Sister Mary Noel, which was just about whether you'd had experiences of some of those adoptees who had had a desire to try and find their families of origin. Do you know if...
Oh, indeed.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That, I think, since, you know, probably, what, maybe 2005, has been one of the topics of conversation. Well, even before that, I would say the refrain, yes, you tell us about war and poverty, but what is it about me that caused my mother to give me up? And through the years, adoptees have been very assertive about uncovering every stone that they could in order to find links for them to locate birth family. And that goes on, you know, constantly. And of course, as we speak now, the scientific DNA method by which adoptees can find blood relatives is miraculous, really. It's, you know, it's nothing that we really dreamed of when we're picking them up from a crib in 1973 to the point where, you know, 40 years later, that child is with his or her father our mothers. It's really a miraculous story. For some, that won't materialize on this side of heaven because they had no documents. We had no identification. And so what was needed for them to get an adoptive family was provided for them, but it in no way is the name that their birth mother would have given them, the date on which they actually were born, nor the name of the woman who gave birth to them. Those facts were not known, but they had to have a document in order to leave, and sisters of various orders throughout South Vietnam were willing to provide that so that those orphans could have their own family.
Sister Mary Nell Gage. And Lana, just at the end of Sister Mary Nell's interview there, she was raising that issue about how pragmatic, I mean, realistically, a lot of the people who were on the ground with these children were trying to get the documentation together for them, some of them without documentation clearly because they'd been left at orphanages or dislocated through the war. And what sort of problems did that provide? I wanted to ask you, I know that at some point there was actually a court case brought in San Francisco by a guy called Tom Miller who was trying to challenge the legitimacy of some of the adoptions. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I do recall that. And we did have INS people who came to our home and took my daughter's footprints. And that was part of that court case. I'm not certain. I know it was resolved, but I really don't recall exactly how it was resolved. But, of course, we've all thought about this for 40 years. I have a website created by Charlie Wilbur, www.vietnambabylift.org. And every week we get one or two emails, some weeks more, from birth families, parents searching for their long-lost children, sometimes siblings. We also hear from Vietnam veterans who know that they fathered children in Vietnam and want to find them. The stories are very compelling, very emotional. We do have volunteer network. We try to help, and every so often people do reunite. And, you know, I do feel in a perfect world, no child should ever have to be separated from the birth family. Unfortunately, as Sister Mary Nell was describing, the horrific grinding poverty, the war, the chaos, nothing could be done, I think, at that time except to evacuate the children. Of course, now the DNA testing is available, and there's just so many more avenues open to people to find one another. So I'm very pleased about that.
We're going to take a break. Lana Noon, stay with us. VietnamBabylift.org was the website Lana was referring to there. Stay with us. We're going to come and talk to one of the veterans that Lana was referring to.
All right. We'll be right back on Innovation Friday and Connections. Coming up in our second hour on Innovation Friday, infrastructure. The state's roads and bridges have been a mess, and New York State can't afford to replace all of them or even most of them. The Cuomo administration has not explained the details of how it wants to fund the new Hudson River crossing, for example, and there are new reports about just how bad these problems are. Infrastructure next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Bidding for Good, making online and mobile bidding auctions work for thousands of nonprofits and schools every day. Information at biddingforgood.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Matthew Leonard is the editor of the Innovation Trail, and he's in studio, as he always is, on Innovation Friday. And a bit of a different tack this hour. We've been talking about 40 years since Operation Baby Lift that brought those infants from Vietnam around the world 40 years ago, 1975. And Matthew Leonard has been guiding these conversations. We have another guest now, Matthew.
And you heard Lana just before the break there, Evan, talk about the role the veterans have played. And we're joined now by Billy Terrell. Bill's a Vietnam veteran who was on deployment in Vietnam in the 60s and has maintained a really strong connection to that country ever since. Bill, thanks very much for spending time with us on Innovation Friday.
Absolutely, my pleasure, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a great day. It's a great time. I'm so happy to be involved with the event at the New Jersey Memorial. Vietnam orphans certainly mean a lot to me.
That's great. And Lana's still on the line with us, Lana Noon.
Hi, Lana.
Hi, Billy. How are you?
Good.
So, Bill, can you tell us about your time on the ground? When did you first come into contact with orphanages in Vietnam during your time as an American Army veteran, active American Army personnel?
Well, our base camp was in Thuy Hoa, and Mang Lang Orphanage was in Thuy An, which was North Phuyen province, maybe, I don't know how many clicks north of us now. Matter of fact, I was there in 2013. But anyway, what had happened is the Viet Cong had attacked the orphanage. A few people were killed. 101st Airborne, who we were supporting, went in to get in the fight and hold them off long enough as we supplied the effort. Children were able to get back on the choppers and bring them back into the area. And in late August, Sister Michelle showed up with one or two of the other nuns, I believe it was Sister Modestine, begging for food. They came to our base camp, and we saw them. Lieutenant Shear saw them pulling contaminated cans out of a pit, because a lot of the food that was dropped in, if the cans were broken or dented, we had to burn them. And they were putting them in a sack, and Lieutenant Shear convinced them that that food is contaminated and they couldn't have it. But he gave them $10 in military scrip. An hour later, they came back with a Catholic priest who spoke enough English to let us know that 110 children were crammed in this one end of a very, very small, not-so-sanitary hospital near Thuy Hoa. So I got to give all the credit to Lieutenant Shear to really start this. He went down, and we started taking up collections to get enough money to feed these people. Lieutenant Shear wrote to his parish in Chicago. They did a special collection, and we were able to raise enough money to build a new orphanage. And I'm proud to say that our building is still there. It's now a daycare center.
And what year was the orphanage, the new orphanage finished there, Bill?
Pardon?
Do you remember what year the orphanage, the new orphanage that the funds were raised for was opened?
Yeah, 1966. When I was back there, it's now a daycare center. When I was back in 2013 for the reunion, I took a photo, and I was so pleased to see that our 1966 plaque was still on the building. But Sister Michelle, now 86, 87 years old, and is back in Thuy An at the original Mang Lang Orphanage. They're back in there. And there are some of our babies are now in their 50s in wheelchairs that are still there, which was quite a remarkable reunion.
And I should say, too, Bill, that you're working on a two-hour documentary series for PBS called The Other Side of War.
It covers the whole story of Mang Lang, but I'm happy to say that the last year, 18 months, 2 years since we've been in progress, the more our story got out, the more other veterans came up to the table and say, hey, you know, because we've been getting a lot of press. And Bob Starr, who's going to be with us, contacted me. His outfit, I think 101st Airborne supported and continue to support an orphanage up in Hue. So I always knew that we were not the only people in Vietnam that really did great humanitarian things, which has been a big, big plus in my life.
Stay with us, Bill.
I have to say I'm amazed that the stories that are coming out that are now good. We're going to expand our documentary.
I bet. Stay with us, Bill. Just to talk more about that connection, we're going to hear from one more Operation Baby Lift adoptee who talks very specifically about the events tomorrow and also what she's hoping to do in terms of reconnecting with veterans like yourself. Let's hear from Tia Keevil.
I'm hoping that this event tomorrow will give us a chance for the adoptees to meet some of the veterans and for the veterans to meet some of us, and that we can have a feeling of gratitude and appreciation for all of the work that they did, all of the you know, Vietnam is such a traumatic war. It's still considered as like the gold standard to horror and chaos and, you know, unsensible ways to try to resolve conflict. And a lot of the veterans, Vietnam veterans, probably still wonder or are still looking for ways to come to terms with this and to figure out how they can feel better, move on. And I know it's been 40 years, but, you know, if you've experienced something like war, a part of it would be forever. And I think it's really healing when these two types of groups can come together and appreciate each other.
And so why do you feel, I mean, here you came as a baby and you had your own, you know, challenges, I'm sure, to grow into this fantastic adult that you obviously are, but why do you feel this kind of commitment to the veterans from here who were involved in that conflict?
Because they were really instrumental in getting a lot of us over here into this country. They verbally advocated for us. I mean, they had a chance to actually have meaningful relationships with people in Vietnam, and it helps. It just helps. It's part of a healing process to be able to reconnect with people that you directly impacted their lives in a positive way. You know, like from the ashes come flowers. You know, and we are like the flowers. All of the survivors and adoptees, and the adoptees are completely appreciative of that.
So I understand you also were involved in one of the motherland tours where you went back to Vietnam.
I did. I went back to
What was
Vietnam
that experience like?
Sister Marinelle Gage and with one of the adoptees and with three other adoptees, but one of the adoptees, her father, worked in the U.S. Embassy, and that's how he adopted his child. And he went back with us. And it was just great to be able to go back with people that were in a similar situation so that we could kind of all process it together. And when we were trying to process it alone, like, we didn't have to explain ourselves.
And did that experience, how did that feel when you came back? Did it kind of change or change the nature of your relationship with your adoptive family here in the States? How did that play out?
Oh, it didn't change it at all. It actually made me appreciate everything more. I think being over there, when you first step off of the airplane is nice and conditioned. When you first step off, I just felt so much sweat forming, and I could feel it running down the crack of my back. And I was like, oh, my goodness, it's hot here. And I think when I became pregnant myself and had a child, it made me actually relate to my biological mother. And she was someone I never really thought of, just because I was in such denial that you could choose to leave a child behind. But I'm so grateful that she did, because it gave me a chance to become somebody that I internally could identify with, you know, a female who could have all these options and opportunities to do the things that I wanted to do. So I really appreciate it. After having a child, I ended up really appreciating my mother, my biological mother, so much more. But my adoptive family have always been so supportive of me and encouraging that I go to Vietnam, and in no way would I be offending them if I were going to look back and think about my mother or my biological father.
Right. So it really changed the nature of how you felt about your family of origin, right? More than than the family.
Yeah,
here.
Like I was able to like almost forgive her, my mother.
Right. That would have been a very hard thing to do, but I think from, you know, speaking to people who were adults at the time just getting a sense of how difficult the conditions were and how incredibly difficult the conditions were on the ground, during that period in Vietnam?
Yeah, absolutely. When I went to one of the orphanages, this was an orphanage in Da Nang, and Da Nang was near a major Air Force base, a major United States Air Force base, and so there was a lot of opportunities to have a relationship with the local women there. And when in one of the orphanages that I went back to, they actually had a book that they had kept, it was almost like a handwritten Excel spreadsheet of all the children that had passed through there with the dates and their name and a date of birth. Now, when they found me, they made up a name and a date of birth for me, but they still were able to put an entry in for me. And then they had a little spot where they had people who returned to that orphanage just sign off their name. And they loved that because it gave the nuns closure also, that all their hard work was not in vain, and to be able to see some of the children come back as adults. And they were just so curious how we were and what we did, what we do for a living. And it was just so, that was the first time it ever occurred to me that they would have closure by us coming back as well.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I was able to find my name, and that was just really fun because it's like validation that I really did exist somewhere, that, yes, some of my core, hardcore information was made up, but it's important because you got to have an identity that starts from somewhere. Even if it's not 100% accurate, at least it is something that I can start with like a date of birth and a given name.
Absolutely. Well, here you are, being a caregiver and nursing professional yourself. Do you think that your experience or developing awareness of where you came from and the conditions you came from kind of shaped the decisions you made?
In this line of work, absolutely. To be in a field that's caring, to be in a field where we're taking people who are in a vulnerable situation, no matter where they are in their health care or disease process, to be able to be supportive and to be a part of that is very honoring. To be able to do that type of work. And a lot of it, yes, does stem from having had been the recipient of that type of unconditional caring, people who have never met you to care so much about you.
Tia Keevil, one of the Operation Babylift adoptees. Great, really fantastic insight there. I took note of this thing. She said, from the ashes come the flowers, and where the flowers. I thought that was a beautiful observation from her. We have 2 minutes with our guests, Bill Terrell and Lana Noon. Bill, Tia talking there about the really strong bonds between veterans like yourself and the Operation Babylift veterans, let's say, who are now almost in middle age.
Well, there's no question about it, many years later, and I speak not only for myself but for other veterans that took on wonderful humanitarian efforts, that we at this point in our lives we realize that the orphans, that they provided us with just as much peace and support as we provided them, because having to help those angels, those were the peaceful moments, going to the orphanage, spoon feeding them. When I taught the boys to play baseball at Mang Lang, that's all they wanted to do after that. It was such a wonderful experience, I've been suffering from PTSD. I'm in counseling now, finally, after 45 years, and I'm doing pretty well. But now rediscovering and revisiting my orphanage experience has been such a healing process for me. And it's just a wonderful thing. And I'm really excited about tomorrow, about being with all these wonderful folks. But it gave a lot of meaning to our efforts, because it was a really tough time. And this is a positive result of it, and it's it's very heartwarming and very settling for me.
Well, Bill Terrell, thank you for taking the time with Matthew Leonard and myself, Evan Dawson, here on Connections. Great to get your perspective on Operation Baby Lift. Thank you so much.
And Lana Nguyen.
My pleasure.
And Lana Nguyen, who's been with us for the whole hour. Lana, thank you so much. VietnamBabyLift.org. And also for more on the last days of Vietnam, tune in to WXXI TV, April 28th at 9 p.m. And also go to WXXI.org/veterans for more on veterans' issues and affairs.
Thanks, Lana.
For having us. Thank you so much.
All right, short break. We're talking New York State infrastructure next hour on Innovation Friday on Connections.